now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here's your host, MC Blair.
Hey, good morning, good morning. Good morning to you. This is MC Blair. I am with Joel Slezak from Free Union Grass Farm. Let's see if that mic works, Joel.
Hey.
Up.
Maybe. How's that?
Can you hear me?
All right. Great. I can hear you now. Awesome. Yeah, we always have a couple technical difficulties to get this thing started, but it always turns out well as long as the information is good and we have a good heart and lots of smiles, all that sort of thing. So, hey, I understand I was just down at the new Winter City Market down at the Ix Art Park, where you guys are, and I got some stuff from your lovely bride, Erica, today. Looks like that's going to do pretty well, and you guys pioneered that, didn't you?
Yeah, we started doing a winter drop spot when the Charlottesville City Market ends. We had a dedicated customer base that would come and buy from us weekly at the Ix, and they've been very generous and supportive of what we're doing. And sure enough, this year they started a official farmer's market, and it looks like a great success.
So, that is awesome.
Yeah, really excited about it.
So. Oh man, that's really awesome. So that's just going to go right on through until
April. Yeah, basically end of March. So and then the regular city market will pick back up in April.
Right.
So,
okay. Yeah. Are they going? I heard something about them building some sort of a place where it was indoors, or
yeah, what? I think for probably more than 5 years they've been discussing how to house the city market and where to put us, and coordinating with the development projects and the condos that are going in. So it's I know very little about it. It keeps changing one day to the next.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Let's hope there's something for the farmers eventually.
Well, let's hope so. Right now, I think what's going on, you still are able to get out there and talk to the customers. And I know the customers don't mind coming and putting up with a little weather sometimes. So.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the main name of the game is location. And sure enough, downtown Charlottesville is a great spot. So
it is.
As long as we can stay close to downtown, we're happy.
There you go. Yeah, it adds to food access.
Sure.
You know, brings the farms into the city, which,
right,
of course, that's all the farmers markets are like that. So tell our listeners that hadn't heard you before a little bit about Free Union Grass Farm.
Sure. My name's Joel, and my wife and I run a diversified livestock operation called Free Union Grass Farm, and we started in 2010 with pasture chicken, and we've grown to grass-fed beef, free-range eggs, chicken, duck, and forest-fed pork. And we raise everything on pasture. All the animals, encompass a little bit of grass in their diet, and it's the right way to raise animals. It's healthier for the animals, healthier for the soil, and creates a much better product, healthier for the humans as well that eat it. So,
yeah.
And it's been great for the local economy as well to see the local food movement grow.
I agree. And then I guess it's more of a system, right? I mean, it's like a whole, the whole, with the soil and the grass and the animals, and then the animals eat the grass and
so yeah, there's a lot of symbiosis
rotation,
going on. And
yeah,
when you have cows on pasture, it's important to rotate them.
Mm-hmm.
And a rotational grazing method creates a healthier grassland where the grass is able to regenerate once the cows pass through it, and then because the cows are taking away from the grassland and not putting back as much, we bring the chickens in, which then fertilize the grass, which then gives it that, that boom of fertility and growth. And so it's also a way to maximize your land. So in Albemarle County, land is hard to come by. It's, it's an expensive place to live. So the most we can, maximize that dollar out of each acre, the best way to do that for us is to do a pastured rotational grazing system where you can raise not only cows, but you can raise cows, chickens, ducks, and pigs all in one area,
Right.
And as long as you keep them moving, you get a return on investment with a healthier soil, and you get a bigger bank account because you're able to raise more animals on a single acre.
Oh wow. Well, I hadn't thought about that. Huh, that's kind of cool. So now I have noticed that I'll go by cattle operations that don't use the rotational system, and they're just grazing on, you know, whatever's laying on the ground as opposed to nice, fresh, green grass. And so the rotational prevents overgrazing.
It does, yeah. And we actually do, it's a little bit complicated because we do heavily graze certain times of year, which means you're really knocking the grass all the way down. And so it looks like a, it looks almost as if it's overgrazed. But by immediately moving them from that paddock, the grass is able to regrow. And by constantly kind of giving that pasture exercise by allowing it to grow and then get eaten off and then regrow again, you're creating a healthier root system. The old roots die off, they break down, create more organic material, and that's kind of how you build soil versus deplete. If you do a, if you don't rotate your cattle, the cows will continually pick off the, you know, the little nubs of grass that keep coming up. And that, that stand of grass never really is able to develop, really take root. So there's so many reasons why this is the superior method of grazing.
I was talking to one grass farmer, and he mentioned that as long as you didn't let the cattle eat past that first growth spurt, like if you think of bamboo, you know, of course, that's the biggest grass, right? So it comes up, and you have all those, you know, divisions, and so... I assume grass is the same way, and you have the first growth spurt, and then a second growth spurt, and a third.
Sure.
And if as long as you don't let them eat past that first, then that root system is, you know, still kind of there.
Right.
He also said that each for every inch that the cows eat of the grass, 1 inch of the root system dies.
That's
and
correct.
That's what the Yeah, so there you go.
And that's how you call that, you know, that's how we describe that ebb and flow.
Ebb and flow.
Building soil.
Right.
And so a pasture, you know, a grassland without any animals on it is inefficient and it's unhealthy. So a grassland wants to be grazed. So the important part is how do you graze it effectively and naturally? And for us, that is moving the cows every day. So
that is really interesting. And I don't know why, I call me crazy, my mind works this way. I immediately go back down to a battery in a computer or in your car or your phone, and it needs to breathe, you know, get depleted and recharged. And as long as that keeps going up and down, rather than just staying fully charged all the time, the battery lasts longer. So same way with the soil. As long as you're grazing and regrowing and grazing and regrowing, that soil is breathing, if you will.
Right.
You know,
for sure.
So that, and then healthy soil and animals raised on healthy soil are obviously healthier, right?
And the other part of that is if you leave a cow in 1 acre of pasture, they're going to continually go to the spots they like the best. So they're going to go to what we call the ice cream. So they're, you know, they're not the smartest animals out there. So every, you know, if that little ice cream shoots up a blade of grass, they're going to go pick that off every time. So if you don't move them, they're continually going to the same spot and eating the best grass. And then the best grass is, they lose out because they're getting picked on, basically, and the, you know, the less palatable grasses proliferate because they're not getting eaten. So by forcing the cow into a smaller paddock and eating the grass down and then moving them out of there, it creates more even playing field for the pasture as well. So not to mention you're distributing the manure more evenly. So likewise, if you leave an animal in one place for its whole life, you know, it's going to be a, you know, ecological disaster of just, you know, manure pile up. And that's how you get the, you know, the factory hog houses and chicken houses.
Yep.
It's just this, the manure that then leaches out, you know, every time it rains, it leaches right into the Chesapeake Bay. So
you're listening to Your Health right here on 94.7 WPVC, the voice of resistance right here in Charlottesville. And we're talking with Joel Slezak from Free Union Grass Farm. This is MC Blair. Keep with us now. You know, I noticed that, let's see. Oh, yeah, your hogs. you know, I've done some reading, and it looks like, obviously, you want to rotate your cattle every day to a fresh pasture and your chickens same way. But it seems like the hogs, since they root around and make their little holes and stuff like that, that they like, don't you leave them in their paddock just a little bit longer before you rotate them, like
we do 1 to 2 weeks for hog paddocks. And that's partially just because of our scale. We're not it's one of the smaller parts of our business, so we're only doing, you know, 20 to 30 hogs in a paddock at a time. And again, we're moving those through the woods because we've actually done experiments where we'll put hogs on pasture and then hogs in the woods, and they almost always prefer to be in the woods. There's more to eat for them, more bugs, more roots. Acorns is a big one for sure. And they also are, you know, pretty warm-blooded. They don't have a, they have a thick coat that doesn't allow them to breathe, so they actually prefer being in the shade of the trees.
Oh.
So it'll be, you know, 50 degrees out, and you'll see them hiding. Hiding in the shade, so so they prefer the woods as well. And as long as you keep them moving, they're not going to destroy the woods, and they're not going to kill the trees. And they, in a way, they're kind of composters. So they're going into a woods full of, you know, a fresh pack of leaves, and they're turning those up and composting and creating a healthier woodland as well.
Oh man, yeah, that's so there. That hence the forest raised. On your website when you talk about your pork,
right?
Forest raised, so that's cool. I've seen a couple of other forest raised operations, and the pork is outstanding. You know, just like
it is,
yours.
Yeah.
It's really good, and then the hogs seem to be a lot happier too.
They are, yeah, absolutely.
So hogs don't do what cows do in a forest, right? They leave a lot of the underbrush and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they take out a, you know, they take out a good amount if you give them time to. But there's also, you know, I'm not, you know, a scientist on this subject, so I can't, you know, claim anything specifically. But, you know, when animals go in and clean out the understory, that often, you know, can revitalize, you know, a potentially a dying forest or something that's not as healthy. So, yeah.
So have you given any thought to, like, food access? I mean, how?
We think about it all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, our product is very expensive. Part of that expense is a little misconstrued because the industrial food is so inexpensive. Part of that reason for that is because of agricultural subsidies.
Subsidies, yeah.
And so it's definitely not an even playing field. With that said, I think, yeah, it does come down to, I think the biggest thing we can do is educate people to understand that even though our food is expensive, there's a way to cook it and prepare it that can, you know, extend your meals, you know, roasting a chicken, pulling the meat, roasting the bones. Bone broth is a huge thing right now. And all those, you know, millions of pounds of bones that are thrown away every year in people's kitchens can be turned into a, you know, a healthy, you know, a healthy nutritious drink. So,
yeah,
as an example.
Oh, man. So, on that. On that subject, there's a product that I use, collagen peptides from pasture-raised beef. And basically, it's, you know, the collagen that you get in your bone broth, which is nice. And it, I guess what it's like is eating, or you know, for every cup of collagen peptides that you drink, you're probably getting the equivalent of 5 or 6 cups of bone broth.
Right.
So it's sort of concentrated bone broth. And that stuff is amazing. Have you ever heard of those?
I haven't.
Well, they're just this so interesting. And of course, it has to come from pasture raised beef. But it's a peptide, you know, a powder form. And you mix it in. I mix it in warm vegetable broth, you know. It basically, if you have any arthritic pain or, you know, joint pain of any kind, it's gone. And
wow.
Because it just goes right, that collagen goes right to those joints and just refreshes, you know, because it's supposed to have that, you know, that the collagen, that layer, so that you're not bone on bone, but it refreshes the collagen so it's nice and slick and, you know, fully lubed and everything. And so, therefore, the pain is gone. And also, in the hand, when you get older, you start getting these sort of cords and stuff. There's a collagen pad that sits in everybody's hand that protects the tendons and the nerves and everything in your hand. And some people, that it'll dry up to the point where their fingers are curled. They can't straighten their fingers. And at that point, the doctors have to go in there and remove that pad. And so I noticed, as an ancillary benefit of taking the collagen peptides for my joint pain, that all these cords and nodules on that pad started going away, right?
Great.
And they used to be painful, and now there's no pain and only a couple of them left, and they keep going away. And I noticed an ad that said it had a picture of these cords and then, you know, the pain lines and everything in the print ad. And it said, new revolutionary therapy. And it had the name of the drug, but then, of course, in parentheses, it has what it is. And it was collagen.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
And it was 6 injections for only $26,000.
Yeah.
So I said, well, let's see. 3 months supply, $40, divided into 26. Tell you what, give me 5,000 and I'll keep you pain free for the next 10 years, you know. So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's a collagen peptides. And
how often do you take that?
I take it every day.
Nice.
And it depends on how many, the number of scoops that you take depends on how much pain you have.
Mm-hmm.
My wife could barely walk with her knees. And she started taking 6 scoops. Now she's down to 3,
wow.
And her knees are pain-free.
Amazing.
She's going to have to get a knee replacement. Now she doesn't.
Wow.
So that's kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, so, that's amazing.
So that, and again, one of the benefits from pasture-raised cattle. And, of course, bone broth, like you said, does the same thing. You just have to drink more of it.
Right.
That's all, you know? So it's really cool, folks. Using the whole animal, and of course our, you know, forefathers, our ancestors did all that, and a lot of them still do. You know, all the leather they get, the ropes and knives, and strings and, you know, horns and all that stuff. Speaking of horns, have you ever tried the biodynamic?
I haven't, no.
Full biodynamic, yeah.
We hear about it, and are you talking about where they bury the horns?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know anything about it, yeah.
Yeah, so. But basically it's regenerative agriculture, mm-hmm. which, quite frankly, I love that term.
Sure.
That's just sort of come into our vernacular. The regenerative agriculture sort of says everything.
They're right.
Just regenerating on a daily basis, and mm-hmm. as you pointed out, the soil, it's all about the soil.
Yeah.
You know?
One hidden benefit of that as well is that what comes to mind is I was outside this morning doing chores, and part of it's because it was so warm yesterday, and it finally rained. It's been really dry here, and the birds were just covering all the trees, and there's a ton of, you know, natural wildlife
right.
You know, blossoming outside. And part of that is, you know, creating a diversified livestock farm and raising animals on pasture. It's different from just an organic monoculture or an organic hoop house or anything, because when you're raising, you know, animals or plants the right way in nature, you're working with the environment versus against it. And so you're allowing the natural environment to coexist with your farm. And that's an added benefit. So all those birds that are, you know, going to the bathroom in the fields
and
helping fertilize as well. And, it's, you know, it's just another example of the symbiosis that we're working with. So
that is awesome. We're going to take a little break, Joel, and folks, we will be back. Very, very shortly. And we are back right here at To Your Health. This is MC Blair, and I am interviewing Joel Slezak of Free Union Grass Farm. He can be accessed at the Ix Park on Saturday morning, and that's during the winter. And a lot of other vendors that are at the city market are also there, which is really cool. And, of course, Joel and Erica, his lovely bride, started that about 3 years ago, and it's blossomed into helping a lot of other vendors, which, of course, that's what it's about, folks, community. You know, people helping people for the greater good. And man, oh, man, I get so excited about it. I know you can't tell. I wanted to talk, Joel, about this Local Soil Health Champions Receive Conservation Awards, which is cool, right? And this is actually from the Bridgewater brothers, Kevin and Steve Cron, and Augusta County farmer Ryan Blosser. You said you knew of
yeah, I know
Ryan?
Ryan, yeah.
Oh, you know Ryan. Oh, okay. So I guess he's in the same that this is, I think they're talking about dairy farms, although they do have 100 head of beef cattle as well. And this is in Rockingham County, which is really cool. Maybe you ought to look at that. Maybe you should get it next time. You know, I don't know if it's just, you know, local or whatever. I'm not sure it doesn't look like where the award comes from. But anyway, they talk about the, you know, no-tilling planting, cover crops, manure storage, side dressing, nitrogen. Huh. What is that? You know?
Which one?
Side dressing nitrogen?
I don't actually know.
Don't know. I'm thinking, oh.
Never tried it.
I was thinking, you know, what? What is that?
The no-till, though, is a big thing these days.
Uh-huh.
And we've realized that part of the carbon problem and part of the global warming problem is the carbon, emissions that are coming from agriculture. And one of the biggest things is we think, oh, it's coming from cows. It's from cows, you know, off-gassing or whatever. But it's actually a big part of it's coming from tilling the land. And each time you, you know, dig a plow into the land, you're releasing all that built-up carbon.
Yeah.
And so even if you're a veggie farmer or, you know, a crop farmer, you know, every time you till that land, you're disturbing this, you know, the carbon bank in the soil. And so by finding new ways to grow crops and to grow vegetables is an important step.
What about just drawing a little line, you know, like with a stick or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure the specifics of it.
Yeah.
But again, that's part of the reason we raise animals on pasture is because, you know, a healthy grassland doesn't need to be tilled. And
yep.
we're not changing anything besides just building the soil versus depleting it or tilling it. So,
man. So, I was talking with another Joel Salatin. Actually back at, 03, and he was telling me, took me on a tour of the farm and showed about the carbon sequestration and how, you know, their fields never needed, fertilizing or water or anything. And their fields are drought proof because they've been doing it since his parents started it back mm-hmm. in 60. And it's just, because the soil is so healthy and aerated due to all the animals, and then it's squirmy because of all the microbes in there that are supposed to be in there. And so the fields don't freeze, and they don't need watering because they wick the aquifers and groundwater. Mm-hmm. They're just one big, the whole field is a well, if you will. And so it just keeps going and going, and fields on both sides are brown and hard dirt and all that, and which his was back when they bought it in the 60s.
Right.
And now, of course, if you've been out there, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've seen it. It's gorgeous, you know, the way they do that.
The more you can take care of the soil, the more, you know, the more water it will hold, and the more drought resistant you become. And we've seen it ourselves, even the short period we've been doing it, you know, almost 8 years now. You know, we've withstanded droughts every year. It's been very dry every summer, and we're able to just hang on. Part of it is rotation. So by moving the cows every day, you don't have to return to that initial spot for, you know, 40 to 60 days. So that's a big part. You know, if it doesn't rain for 2 months, you have just enough time by the time your herd, you know, reaches that starting point, to regrow. And then not to mention just soil health and compost and fertility just really holds that water in. So
that's amazing. So tell us a little bit about how you got started. I mean, you've been at it 8 years, which to me, that's a long time, but obviously in the sense of farms, that's just getting started.
Sure, yeah.
I met you first when you were the cheesemonger up at Feast,
right?
For Kate, you know, and then we'll go into it.
I think there were two inspiring moments. One was reading about Polyface Farm, and mainly actually just seeing his method for making a profit, you know, and, cause that's, you know, obviously the most important thing when you start a business is, you know, how are you going to make money? And, he had showed through his literature and through just his farm itself that it can be profitable to be a small farmer and to be a ecological farmer. So that was the first step. And the second was working at Feast and seeing, the demand for local food and seeing the passion in all the customers like yourself who'd come in and just, you know, just, borderline obsess over what good food is. And so, yeah, Feast was definitely, a springboard to kind of tapping into the local food scene and how to sell food. So, that was huge. Kate Collier and, Eric Kirtner were, kind of pioneers in Charlottesville, and still are. And I met Erica. She was actually working at Polyface And she came in delivering turkeys one day, and it was love at first sight.
The rest is history, so, baby. Right. That's right.
But we started out just with pasture chicken.
And oh, okay.
Part of that is because that's the cheapest and easiest way to get into farming because it's the fastest turnaround. Only takes 2 to 3 months to raise a chicken. And the infrastructure is low. You don't need a big tractor. You don't need, you know. Yeah, we didn't even have a four-wheel drive truck. And so we were able to raise 600 chickens the first year, just with the two of us, a two-wheel drive truck and a Subaru Outback. And we just peddled the streets selling chicken, didn't even have a business card, and grew from there. So, but what's also nice about starting with chicken is it's the first thing to help revitalize a pasture. You know, so our pastures also were overgrazed for 30 years, you know, continually grazed. And by pulling the cows off and laying down chicken manure, that grass bounced back so fast and just created that base layer for the farm as well. So it was kind of, it feels good starting with that, you know, that enterprise as well. And I would encourage anyone starting out to just start small and do something that's not going to put you in a lot of debt. And, yeah.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Hey, folks, you're listening to Your Health right here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, the voice of resistance right here in beautiful Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm MC Blair. I'm talking with my friend Joel Slezak from Free Union Grass Farm, always at the city market, I guess April through December, downtown and on Water Street, and then at the Ix Park from right now all the way through the end of March. So on Saturday mornings, always good to get down there and then see the rest of the vendors too. It's a real nice community. And of course, we stress community here on this show. I always say community-based agriculture, different from a CSA, community-supported agriculture, which is the program where you order food or you buy certain shares and you get so much food each week. But CBA, I guess, community-based agriculture, to me is the key to a healthy community. It really is. I've always said if you get too tied up in politics, just go back and see who you can volunteer for in the community-based agriculture and just immerse yourself in that and you'll be a lot less stress in your life, that's for sure. So what's your background? I mean, you know, you just said, well, I'm going to start a farm. I mean, did you guys have like farming in your backgrounds?
Erica had no previous farming experience. Besides working at Polyface, which was really a big, you know, stepping stone for our business. You
didn't
know,
she
having
do something
her background
with Gale for a while.
She did work with Caramon as well the second year. I grew up on a little homestead. Parents moved to Charlottesville in the 70s and bought a dairy cow, and we were raised on raw milk and raw cheese, and that was definitely an integral part of where I am today. And I went to college, studied politics, and got out in, 2008. There wasn't much going on with the economy then, and just started dabbling in farming, and it was just the right place at the right time as well for the local food movement, and it seemed it did. It's incredibly challenging starting a farm and a business, but regardless, starting a farm in Charlottesville has been, I'd say, as easy as it can get, in terms of the customer base and the support that we had through really generous landlords, giving access to property, and then obviously the bustling Charlottesville food scene. Technically, not a real ag background, but enough to make it work, and here we are today.
Yeah, so. Well, it seems like you have a passion to really, bring good food to your customers, and of course to your family first.
Yeah, we'll never starve to death. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I think every year when I look back at the year or look forward, I do think the silver lining with anything is just seeing the health of the soil just grow and grow and grow, and the excitement of wondering what it'll look like in 50 years or 100 years. And I think that's really what gets me up in the morning and keeps me going. So
let me ask you this, Joel, in the line of food access, which I know is very near and dear to you, your heart, and Erica's as well. Like for the folks that maybe they don't have the means to, you know, come into a city market and pay, you know, $7 or $8 a pound for something they can get for $2 a pound at one of the local grocery stores, or God forbid going to a convenience store buying processed food. One farmer said that if the whole community were to buy into a system of a sliding scale, then it would work. Meaning that the person with less means, they're going to pay $2 a pound for pastured pork, but people with more means are going to pay $14. Right. And so, and the rest are going to pay your normal price of $10 if you're talking about chops or that kind of thing. So, wouldn't that work?
It's worth a try. I think, you know, having a pay what you can day, events like that could be a good starting point. I do know the SNAP program, the food stamp program, it looks successful from our point of view. We see a lot of customers with food stamps come and spend dollars with us, and they're not buying filet mignon, they're buying, you know, staples, ground beef, ground pork, whole chickens,
right.
And they're also able to, there is a SNAP program which allows them to double their dollar value with us. So we've seen that. I'm trying to think if it's grown over the past 2 years or not. I can only remember it going back 1 or 2 years. I would say I think we've accepted more food stamps this year than last year. So I guess you could say it's growing with us. But that seems like an incredible program. And I don't think it's necessarily, it could be better advertised, perhaps.
I think you're right.
And really to encourage those people on food stamps to show up at the farmer's market.
Yeah, about education.
There is image that farmers markets are too expensive or elite, but I really do disagree. I really think that if you really dig deep and look at the farmers market prices and talk to the farmers, you'll find that there's always a cheap option at every booth. And not to mention that I do believe if it is cheaper than going to, you know, Whole Foods or even Trader Joe's, you know. So,
well, it is. And the other thing too is based on, like you mentioned, the cost, or we were talking about the cost of food. Folks, the true cost of food, if the farm subsidies were taken away from these big factory farms, you would be paying more for that, more for conventional, than you would for local organically grown produce, real food.
Yeah.
Because those chemicals and pesticides and all that sort of thing are very expensive. And they're not, you know, because of the subsidies, that all that cost is, gone away.
Not to mention just keeping the money in Virginia.
Yeah, that's huge.
And not only are the consumers who are buying from us keeping that dollar in Virginia, but the farmers are keeping that money in Virginia too, because the old school method of raising cattle was, you know, have a calf, you know, fatten it up, wean it, and then ship it off to, you know, Kansas, Texas,
yeah,
or Colorado, and that money's gone. It's not
gone.
Coming back. So, you know, keeping the livestock here, keeping, you know, the corn farmers are keeping that grain here that we're using. So it's multifaceted.
It is. It is. That's so, so true. And one of the things that I had thought of was to try to bring food. I know, I guess what, you know, it's like trying to put myself in, say, a single mom or a single dad, can't put myself in a single mom's shoes, you know, but say a single dad's shoes, I can do that. You're working, maybe you're working a couple of jobs to try to keep your kids right and everything and get them in schools. And you don't, it's easy to fall into the trap of, I don't have time to prepare something from scratch.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, you do if you take Sunday off or one of your days off, if you have a day off, hopefully you do, and get the kids involved with food prep and all that, and make a bunch of meals ahead and freeze them, and then during the week you can just pop them in a, you know, boiling bag or whatever it is you do. But let's just say that you really don't have the time, and so that's why you stop at McDonald's or you stop at KFC or you stop at a pizza place on the way home, and then that's dinner. What if there were a brick and mortar establishment close to, say, an urban area, or a food truck that would go into these areas and bring, quote, fast food, but made with local ingredients from and sourced locally from the local farms, either through a big discount that the farm could do that as a discount, hopefully work with the city for tax credits, mm-hmm. or just get a lot of or just donate a certain portion so that the people would have access to the food. And then I'm thinking once they started that, then they might go to the city market, might spark them to go. I mean, do you think that's even viable, something like that?
Yeah, maybe so.
Selling prepared foods.
I like the idea of a traveling farmer's market food truck or something. You know, mm-hmm. I've seen those school buses turned into farmer's markets. And, you know, if you take the farmer's market right into, you know, less prosperous areas, perhaps that would help. Definitely food access is important. I mean, case in point, this is the first year we've had a real winter farmer's market. So, you know, I've noticed it, you know, we have booming sales from April to December.
Right.
And then, you know, if there's no market, you know, people just stop coming. You know, we do email lists and drop spots and, you know, it's good. We have a very dedicated customer base, but those that aren't quite as motivated, you know, they go to the grocery store and they skip the market. So I really do think it's about food access. You know, the price thing, that's really complicated. It's controversial. It's hard to ask a farmer to charge less if they can't do it. But more so just, you know, gaining access for sure is a big part of it. And I think the Food Hub is doing that pretty well with, they're trying to.
Institutionally, they are with the restaurants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are.
Getting food into public schools and stuff like that.
But that's the other one, the City Schoolyard Garden Program. Mm-hmm. Seems to be growing.
Good.
They were in just a couple of schools. I think they've gotten some more now from what I get the literature. And we've had them on the air here before. I want to get them back and see their progress. But there's the other one is the City Schoolyard Garden. Anytime you can get the kids involved, then all of a sudden, you know, they want it. Then they go home and say, oh, Mom, buy us some collards or spinach or, you know, whatever. And I'll show you how we do it. You know, sure. I'll show you how we prepare it from school. And, you know, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah. It does start with the kids and the younger generations. Always they're changing the minds of the older generations. In my opinion, I think there's always a funny time. Every Thanksgiving, everyone comes out of the woodwork to find a local turkey. You know, they may not shop locally every week, but they always, you know, there's always a huge influx of local folks looking for a local turkey. And often I can tell, I see it's the kids coming home from college or, you know, learning about local food in high school and saying, hey, where's my local turkey? You know, so I think it does take the younger generations to remind, you know, everyone else that, hey, it's time to change.
Yeah, so, I agree. Joel, we're going to take another little break here.
No offense to your generation.
my generation. Hey, what? Baby boomers, baby. Anyway, we're going to take another break, and we will be back. And we are back. This is MC Blair, To Your Health, right here at 94.7 WPVC. And I'm interviewing Joel Slezak. Came in here, took time away from the farm to come in here. He's at Free Union Grass Farm, and they can be accessed each Saturday morning at the Ix Park through the winter, and then, of course, April through December at the City Market downtown on Water Street. So, Joel, we were talking about how it starts with kids. I do want to touch that a little bit more, and how they can get the kind of get the ball rolling in the families. Is that sort of how you see it?
Yeah, I think that's
part of it. What about taking, we mentioned like a food truck. I mentioned a food truck, and you said you'd seen school buses converted into mobile farmers market. What about one converted into a mobile education, kitchen education, food preparation education, how maybe you know, people could come in, you know, and then learn from chefs. Chefs could donate their time, and you know, they could prepare something real quick. And, the families, you'd have three or four families at a time coming in. I don't know, just to,
sure.
you know,
yeah.
call me crazy, right? I think that might work as well, because it is education. You know, once people really know, and then know and taste, it's just like we were talking about the kids. Kids come in. They would never eat this particular food, whatever it happened to be. until they see it prepared, you know, locally harvested and then prepared, and then they help prepare it. And all of a sudden, wow, this is really good. And then they want it, you know, that kind of thing. So, so that's a good, keep on going, City Schoolyard Gardens. You guys are doing a lot of good, here in Charlottesville. I noticed this article about pesticide use and how not only, and we hear that, pesticides, antibiotics and all this thing, but the pesticides, we hear about it. Oh, yeah, well, it's on my vegetables, but no big deal. I can just wash it off and I'm fine. What about the workers that are applying and working in the fields? Isn't that more of a...
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I've noticed that the larger scale you get in agriculture, I'd say the less taken care of the farmers are. And you see it in slaughterhouses, especially, and I'm sure you see it in the big monoculture, you know, veggie crops and orchards and stuff like that. So,
wow.
Yeah.
And what about the antibiotics in animals, which is?
So, yeah, there's, the two kind of schools of thought on antibiotics. There's the antibiotics that you do selectively. So you have a sick cow and you apply antibiotics to, you know, save that cow, which can be, you know, I think that can be argued as acceptable if it's very intermittent and, you know, and used for the right reasons. And, you know, if it's about, you know, humane treatment of animals, you know, you want to take care of a sick cow. Obviously, you have to wonder, why is that cow sick? You know, perhaps it's because of mismanagement or raised in a factory. But I think the real problem with antibiotics is feeding it to large scale hog houses and poultry houses, basically to improve the gut bacteria, which allows them to grow more and gain weight faster. And so, and keep them healthy in a really toxic environment. So, and that I think is what is creating those, antibiotic resistant, bacteria. So,
well, yeah, I had heard that, one of the main reasons not to use, overuse of antibiotics. And that's, of course, as you'd pointed out, you use it selectively if you have a sick animal. And I know many grass farmers, if they have a sick animal, they do cull it from the herd. They
right.
treat it, but then they ship it off to another farm nearby or because they're not going to let it get back into the herd. It stops the... It corrupts it.
It
has a chance of corrupting
the
herd. But the use of antibiotics, overuse of antibiotics, folks, those antibiotics stay in the meat. And so when you go to the store and you buy, you know, the meat from the store, not from the local farms, not from a pastured operation, you are getting some antibiotic. And just think about that. Let's say you do that for a while, and then all of a sudden you need an antibiotic. And they give it to you, and it doesn't help at all. It there's no response because that antibiotic is the bacteria that you're trying to kill off have already mutated so many times that they are now immune to that particular antibiotic, and so they have to keep going, and then you suffer from that. Another reason to buy local pastured pork and poultry, grass-fed beef, right?
Right.
Absolutely. You know, so what, I mean, how could that, I've tried to think of the, you know, I try to think of solutions and, you know, I say, well, you know, if we could ever have a government that said anything that threatens the soil, the water, or the air, can't happen. Wouldn't that be nice, right?
Well, it does come down to consumer demand, and the big companies are paying attention because, you know, I've read that Purdue chicken, you know, large scale chicken, factory chicken company, they are removing antibiotics from their feed program. So, and the reason they're doing that is not because of, you know,
they should.
Because because they're getting thousands of calls a week from people saying, hey, why is there antibiotics in my chicken? You know,
so
it does work, and you know,
that's
with your dollar.
That's good, but what about in the crowded situation? By the way, if you ever, folks, if you ever hear the word CAFO used, that's C-A-F-O, stands for Concentrated Animal Factory Operation, obviously factory farm. So we know that most of the big chicken producers, the chickens are crowded. They have to dock their beaks, dock their wings, and they're just banging into each other all day long. If you're not using antibiotics, don't they have a lot?
I don't know how they're taking care of that problem.
Yeah.
So I don't know by removing them what they also change, because I assume they'd have to change how they're being raised.
Absolutely. But, they couldn't be raised in such close quarters.
Yeah.
Because that's why they need the antibiotics in the first place, to keep them standing.
Sure.
Just like the cows and whatnot. Well, that's good. So consumer demand definitely is at work here,
right,
in a lot of respects.
Right. Wow. Yeah. We definitely can't rely on the federal government to step in on that issue.
And that's another thing that gets me. And our mutual friend John Whiteside from Wolf Creek Farm. By the way, folks, if you ever get a chance to talk to John Whiteside at Wolf Creek Farm, and you want to talk politics, stand by, because he's definitely he's thought some things through, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things, and I tend to agree, is that we have relied on Uncle Sam, air quotes, daddy, we want him to take care of us. And unfortunately, the more that happens, the more removed we become from our communities. And obviously, you know, those legislators that sit in Washington, they come from all the 50 states. They don't know about our local procedures. They don't know anything about us. But yet we're demanding on them to help us. And it's like, whoa, wait, why can't we just help ourselves, take that,
right,
you know, take it down to a state level or even a county level? But let's say we took it to a state level, then obviously the representatives would be far more familiar with each locale's situation, right? And then with that, because that costs money, the money that we now send to the federal government, we would just stop sending that to the federal government and use it for the state program, which would make sense, right? And of course, the federal government would say, hey, you can't do that, taking our money. So I don't know. I think, sounds good, right?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, good luck on that, right? Staying on food access, is there anything more that you think that could be done on giving access to real food?
I think one of the things is having access to slaughterhouses, for example, one of the things we've come up with. So I guess if we take our biggest, our most challenging, things going forward would be, access to freezer storage to produce more pastured meat. Cold storage is expensive. There are some big companies in the Valley that work with the big companies. They don't want to work with small guys like us. So access to cold storage would be huge. Access to a, you know, humane slaughterhouse that's actually close to Albemarle County. We drive our, you know, we raise these beautiful cows and beautiful pigs, and they have a great life. But on the last day, we got to load them up and drive them all the way over the mountain on 81, and it's probably stressful. And, they're going to Harrisonburg or Lynchburg or Northern Virginia. And if there could be something closer, that would be huge access. And I'm saying this about the farmers, but I think it does spill over into food access.
Farmers, definitely.
One of the reasons, you know, we like being small scale, but we could be a lot bigger. You know, we could have grown bigger, faster, which means more food, potentially lower cost food for consumers, if we had, you know, things such as cold storage, access to slaughterhouses. I think, you know, encouraging off-season, you know, vegetable production, I think would be a boom for the Charlottesville community. I don't know if farmers actually want to do that or can successfully do that, but just, you know, off the cuff, one thing that comes to mind.
Well, speaking of that, Joel, well, before that, you are listening to Your Health right here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is MC Blair, and I'm talking to Joel Slezak of Free Union Grass Farm, and we're sort of addressing food access to all. I had an idea that there's a lot of land that was given to UVA mm-hmm. from the Kluge Foundation. This is right. not bottom. This is not bottom. This is not, you know, wasteland. Right. This is good, viable land. As a matter of fact, one organization, I won't mention who it is, just bought 1,900 or 1,800 acres from them, and that leaves about 3,100 acres of viable land. And I thought that, gosh, wouldn't it be something if through grants or the city or whatever or a combination thereof, or even, you know, a consortium of farmers, maybe 25 or 30 farmers went in, you know, on this as well. So the whole combination, everybody chipping in either money or time or both to build some really nice greenhouses on this land. The university wouldn't have to sell it. They could just give us a land use grant. And then, obviously, that's good for taxes for them. You know, they're getting benefits. And build these greenhouses enough to, you know, provide 70% of the produce or, you know, whatever for the community during the winter. So, and then you'd have people, you know, kids after school work there so that they would, you know, see what's up and spread that to their families and get educated. And then during the summer, you could, the greenhouses wouldn't be growing except for possibly educational, like camps and teaching kids how to run a greenhouse, mm-hmm. you know, how to actually the engineering of a greenhouse, you know, right. and then also obviously how to grow and what nutrients the soil needs to grow certain produce. That would be so cool. And then during the winter as well, the local farmers could come in and donate their time to teach, you know, certain classes when, you know, when their farms is slow on a, if all you have is a produce farm, it's going to be slow in the winter. Mm-hmm. You know, the things you got to do, but not near what you do during the growing season, right? I mean,
right.
doesn't that sound like something
sure, yeah.
that could be awesome?
Absolutely.
And then, you know, obviously during the summer, you wouldn't want to produce because that would take away from the farms and, mm-hmm. and you want to be a giving community. I don't know. That was just a thought that I had. I just, gosh, you know. So anybody listening out there that has influence in, you know, with the city or UVA or whatever, you know, heck, I really believe that would work. And we have one of the premier greenhouse engineers in the area, and Michael Clark at Planet Earth Diversified, who I'm sure would consult on that.
Right.
That's one of the things he does. He's a mm-hmm. consultant, and he would be able to tell us the cost per square foot and for building, and then obviously the yield on the back end of it. And if it was city sponsored or UVA sponsored, the sliding scale could apply.
Right.
So that then the people with the low means could actually access the real stuff, and we would have a healthier community.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, I think, lower childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes.
Right.
How about that?
Yeah.
So then healthcare costs go down.
Right.
And I guess, was it you? I don't know. Somebody, one of the farmers that I was talking about the high cost of the food, and he said, well, you know, you can pay me now or pay your doctor later.
That's right.
It's up to you. And there you go, right?
Wise words, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that made total sense to me. And so kind of, so do you have like, harvest time, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, you have a pretty nice family, right, in the area, don't you? And do you ever get together with the community, the local people where your farm is and share a meal? I'm just
Sure.
Asking.
Yeah, we've got a great community. All our friends are somehow connected with the food scene, whether it be chefs or cider makers or other farmers. Sadly, most farmers don't have time to hang out with each other because we're all too busy farming.
Right. Yeah.
Or we're on different schedules. But great community. And I think one of the other things that keeps us going is, being able to sit down and have a 5-star meal in your house or, you know, with all this great bountiful produce.
Yeah.
And we always, you know, one of the great things about farmers market is being able to barter with your neighbors and, you know, give them a chicken. They give us a bunch of vegetables and every week we're bartering constantly, which, you know, fills our fridge with, you know, non-proteins and non-animal products. So that's been really, gratifying. And another reason to, you know, encourage, affordable food is find a farmer and barter with them. You know, if you can't afford to pay, you know, their prices, then, you know, work for them for a couple hours a week. You know, we've done that with some people and, hired them for part-time work and then pay them in meat. And,
man.
Not sure what the legal ramifications of that are, but you know, exchanging goods for services.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's, that goes back to the beginning of man. I mean, you know, that's how it started, you know, trading stuff. And you know, it's crazy. And I guess, money was invented so that you didn't have to take a wheelbarrow full of, you know, grain or whatever down to trade for a chicken. You know?
Yeah.
that's really, yeah, community, man. It's all about community. I know that we are done.
All right.
We're going to have to wrap it up. And I've had a ball. Really enjoyed being here with you, Joel.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And hopefully come back at some point. How about like a round table with a couple of chefs and that sort of thing?
Yeah. I have more farmers, the better. So
okay.
Keep inviting
so maybe
farmers
get a couple,
on. Yeah.
Couple farmers and maybe get... oh, yeah, by the way, folks, he mentioned the 4-star, 5-star meal. They happen to know Tucker Yoder and Mike Perry pretty good. So that's a couple of top chefs in the area.
That's right.
There you go, right?
Yeah.
And then others, I'm sure. So
yeah.
Thanks, Joel. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Mike.
All
great show.
Man.
You've been listening to Your Health with your host, MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.